Good evening. Tisa Bryant lives in Brooklyn and teaches in Queens. So, what does she read on the subway every morning? I've been reading today and yesterday her Leon Works book to be Unexplained Presence, and can only deduce that she reads how-to guides with great passion. Except, of course, she writes them herself in the first place. Manuals for a breakup, the correct complex wording of a promise, how to survive a history or a gender, how to set up a circus tent, how to be in a body that's changing on you, mutable, extensive, yet is compelling to others in deeply disturbing and pleasurable ways. In other good news, Tisa Bryant is the founding editor of the Encyclopedia Project. This is a sort of magical dictionary in which writers and artists are given a letter or letters, K to M and so on, and invited to respond with abandon, without doing what they've always done. I was given an F and barely knew what to do with myself. Basically, my point is that Tisa Bryant is a complete genius. When asked in a recent interview what defines success as a writer for her, she replied, "Surviving, finishing projects, connecting, those moments when it's clear that someone read or heard something. Of course, when you do, that's always bowled me over. And just getting it, that's always a success. And to not ever feel closed, that I don't have anything else to learn. I never feel that way." Please join me in welcoming Tisa Bryant to the stage.
So nice to see you. It's thrilling to be here. I never knew I always wanted to be here. Now I know. I'm going to read from my book to be from Leon Works. It's called Unexplained Presence. And the short story of it is that it is nonfiction fiction, ruminations on African presences in film, visual art and literature, as well as on the white makers who import those presences in their work. So I'm going to read from one piece called Andre's Masked Ball. I feel like I'm hissing. Am I too close? Okay. Andre's Masked Ball, which is a play by somebody whose name I forget. But I'll tell you later when you ask me. Okay. The music points to time, to skin, to sex, is pointed, to blend, to stand out, points to Edward Ned Kynaston, the last man to act as a woman on the London stage. He is its darling, Kynaston is, brilliant, demanding, a diva, emotionally attached to a blonde wig, clinging to a silk pillow smeared with mouth paint. As his history has it, and its attending playwright, Kynaston was white, but he's been recast in the black Jamaican skin of a very real Andre Thompson, who feels himself as much she as he. Ned Kynaston, white theater drag character, meets Andre Thompson's real-life genderqueer playing the role. They make a third body. Andre Kynaston is born. Andre Kynaston's specialty is Desdemona. Her more is theater owner Thomas Betterton, a white and black face. Classic. Death pillows and puns. How do you die? Playing a woman, as a woman. My Desdemona, why is there a demon in your name and a more at your throat? I die the best. No one plays a woman as well as me, Kynaston says. The music points at him with a white, a modern, an American finger, black. Andre Kynaston is flying high, invited to court by King Charles II for dainties and fine ladies, then beckoned to dark corners for loving from the Duke of Buckingham. No matter the set or what role it plays, a bed is central to the stage. The ensemble cast is deliciously dressed 1660, shod in curlicues, garlanded, draped, wigged, flounced, and painted. Through interludes from stage left and right, wrought iron balconies and in the aisles, the ensemble vogues and vamps, lip-syncing Whitney Houston's I'm Every Woman as flowers are flung at Kinniston's feet. Her Desdemona dies so beautifully. Bravo, Betterton bellows, agreeing then and there not only to give Kinniston, his demanding star, a share of the theater's profits, but final say on any and all casting for future productions. Betterton wipes the bootblack from brow, erasing the more from his skin, but keeping his eye on Kinniston. Mariah, the theater maid, takes the soiled cloth, regards the black, presses it to her face. Ladies send fragrant notes backstage on fine paper to Kinniston's elation. Grinning, she adjusts her bodice, beckoning to sulky Mariah for a hand. Mariah loves Kinniston as him, not her. The world soars and surges, transformed by the restoration. Andre Kinniston thwarts Queen Elizabeth's edict to rid England of the African likes of her. She is not an icon for fine tobaccos hung from creaking tavern signs. She is a star. Rah, cries the crowd. Behind the mask, she thinks, see this brown litheness, caressed, embellished, and so jeweled. My skin points to another music in another place. My accent points, but I have no true speech here. This, my tongue, has no stage nor crown. I am not a drag queen, but dark, royal, and comely. LL Cool J, something like a phenomenon, pulses through her entourage. Andre Kinniston stalks the stage, her prowess doubly punctuated by the ensemble's pelvic thrusts. She twirls, feeling large, giggling between catty snarls. She's giving you realness, realness, playing the role, in the role, and yet the pointing never ceases. What's that? Who's that? Why, that's no woman. Why, that's no man. What's in the pants? The pants. The pants. Body jokes abound. She's the cock of the walk. She's got a full purse in her knickers, of course. News comes from across town that a real woman, a Mrs. Hughes, is playing Desdemona at a rival theater. Women, women, they're not needed. But who dresses you? Not seen, but who listens? Not fit for performance, but who else is fancy for? Andre Kinniston always walks the public lane, still in costume, exalted by powder, perfume, the power of working the stage, a territory demarcated by his, her, misogyny, and by never so dark a line as on the day of auditions at her, his, theater. Andre Kinniston's usurper-to-be has been announced, a Mrs. Hughes to see you, sir. Yet he is haughtily dismissive, secure in his entertaining ascension. Of course he ignores Mariah's doting hands. Of course he ridicules Mrs. Hughes's timid Desdemona, heckles and throws shade. Andre strikes a pose. The light catches the honey in his eyes. Andre Kinniston can, in this quiet moment, interrogate gradations of realness and womanliness along the spectrum that he is the mark of. Were his rival also black and comely? Would the challenge, woman, be a reality? The voice behind your voice, Kinniston, the bounty of press spilling over above hands that proffered cocoa tea or stroked that boy you loved away from you forever. What would you wear for that meeting? Andre pauses then as the young girl's glimmering face recedes from his memory. Not a rival, this Mrs. Hughes, talentless, wan, yet he hates her. Yet he recognizes the threat. Kinniston and Mrs. Hughes exchange barbed quips like jealous schoolgirls. The entourage salivates, stroking their ruffles, taking it in. It is doubled, the threat, for our Andre Kinniston, darling of the stage, wearing how many masks now, how many, in the face of white female realness, white powder and power he refuses to reckon with. He returns to the staged moment. Andre becomes she. Kinniston snakes her neck from the third body they make and blinks saucily. Ah, cries the crowd. There will be more diva for all and sundry, but later, the ladies demur. The Duke of Buckingham lingers with powerful admiration, stroking his ruffled belly. Samuel Pepys eyes it all, writes it down, claiming Kinniston the loveliest woman in the whole house. Pepys and the ladies depart, Chaka Khan's sweet thing plays as Kynaston beds the Duke of Buckingham, wig dome propped up by her favorite pillow. When they have finished their stroke and arch and have scampered out, Mariah strips the bed lovingly, angrily. Kynaston commands the stage, fixated on how he plays Desdemona's death. In her private moments, with Andre Kynaston gone, no longer understudy to her own womanliness, Mariah, clutching Andre's pillow, does Desdemona differently. How to be a man, then? King Charles II has turned his back and changed the law banning women from the stage to one that bans men from playing women. This is the restoration. He wants to see some skin most unlike his. A candy-coated dandy, offended by his hauteur, hired thugs to humiliate Kynaston during his performance, then, in a cruising park later, beat him severely. Look now at Andre Kynaston, gay-bashed and banished from Betterton's, too, having insulted the king's trumpet, a good friend of Mrs. Hughes, and the successful usurper of Andre Kynaston's Desdemona. And yet she's not good. That Mrs. Hughes, she doesn't die well at all. But she is the first woman on stage to Andre Kynaston's last womanly man. The realness of whiteness is silent and strong, girding the realness of woman. Andre Kynaston limps along, clearing pewter from alehouse tables and begging for alms. How to be a man? The Duke has married, to Kynaston's ridicule, a highly placed lady with a bosom-rich purse. The soul and hip-hop soundtrack cease altogether, the ensemble restrained to plaintive string combos. The point now being simply Kynaston's being. The color of her desire is no longer conjoined so thrillingly, so willingly to his skin. He can simply be an actor now. Mary J. Blige's No More Drama does not play. Gone are the blonde wigs and garnet silk corsets. She simply becomes him, Ned Andre Kynaston, abject in homespun breeches. He begs audience with the king, whose trumpet, Nell, in revenge, challenges Kynaston to be a man by playing a man, Othello, no less, and he cannot. His misogyny is turned on him. He is heckled by Nell for not being able to deliver manliness on demand, as he at once, during audition, ridiculed Mrs. Hughes, who sits now, discomfited, not avenged, but oddly saddened. How to be a man? A woman? Andre Kynaston's deep outrage and his voice cannot find each other in sound. This island, England, never called such, and that island I am of, Jamaica, cannot speak for me, through me, here. I slip true. I can't do this thing. No crown shall ring my tongue, but your manhood. Ned Andre Kynaston spirals down, prostituting himself in debauched pubs and bars, nasty songs hurled at his crotch. He lifts his skirt for paltry sums until he's summoned to swallow his girlish pride and teach Mrs. Hughes's Desdemona how to die. His skin remains without music, layering the pointing, spreading it out along pores that pucker and rise with sudden chills. And that black girl who is not you, Andre, does she choke? Does she strangle? Run over your prone body blithely as a gazelle? And that black girl, who is not you, bound for Jamaica sooner or later from that other place, from your 1660s stance, can your vamp save her? Whose Desdemona will she be, and free? How to be a man, Andre Thompson, a black man, or simply Ned Kynaston, nothing but a man? He ponders simply his role, his fate, gray and hungry in the indifferent London streets. Mariah puts Kynaston up, ambivalent but touched by his destitution. Love me, she purrs. How do you do it, two men? Who's the woman? Who's the man? Kynaston softens, and together they try to love, top-bottom, man-woman, expressed like so many confused asanas. Mariah astride him, Kynaston, grabbing wig, moans, guides her hands to his throat. Mariah is repulsed, spits at Andre Kynaston. I hate your Desdemona. You make her die so easily, and that's what's wrong with you. The woman in you is weak. Desdemona would fight, fully reproached in the transformation of role, of body, begins again. Andre Othello sires himself and takes this in, and so humbled by this woman pointing out his flaw, agrees to coach his rival, Mrs. Hughes, to be a tough lady, although he still wants to kill her. He directs her, as her Moor, to play his Desdemona, and his power surges through the Jamaican rumble of rage set free from his throat. He makes her crawl and mince and cower and show her love, bear her fear of his changed heart. He withholds all reciprocity, scheming, plotting, splits himself into his own Iago and Othello, Ned, Andre, Kynaston, whispering jealously into his own ear, "She is unfaithful to your vision. You are every woman, not she. Kill her, make her die." Opening night, Kynaston's Othello is brilliant. Mrs. Hughes gives the audience authenticity, woman afraid, so beautiful. "Oh, ah," they respond, clutching their breasts, catching a view of hers. They step the paces, well-shod and trembling to the near last, when Kynaston artfully strangles Mrs. Hughes within an inch of her life, arching his lithe brown body away from the white talons that snatch desperately at his grimacing face, his taut ribcage. She snatches at him, Mrs. Desdemona Hughes does. She snatches at life before her eyes roll, before her breath falters, before she goes limp. He rises, Andre Kynaston, Andre Othello, bellowing, tall, misled, destroyer. How to be a man? A lover? Then he commits his scripted suicide. He rolls aside as Desdemona scrambles about the floor, gasping realistically, hand to throat, expiring at last. Kill her, make her die. One beat, another, then three. Mrs. Desdemona Hughes retches and coughs, then rising shakily, bows to deafening applause. Thank you. Have unfolded gradually, her gifts as poet and librettist, her extraordinary work as book artist, curator, publisher, in short, her richly varied and sustained work to deepen and enhance the work of making art individually and as a community in an artistically vexed time. She's a Renaissance woman. If you have a question, say, about Japanese art, opera, or even dog training, Jamie Robles will know a lot more about the topic than the average person. She studied with and later lived in the household of Kenneth Rexroth, knew Teresa Cha of Dictée fame, and once helped Ed and Jennifer Dorn find an apartment in San Francisco. In other words, on top of everything else, this woman has excellent dish on many of the luminaries of 20th and 21st century American poetry. But she's never used what she's seen and done in anything but a generous manner. Jamie is a wonder of the writing world, but a wonder that too few people know about, because she resolutely attends to the work at hand rather than calling attention to herself. So let me tell you, because Jamie would never let on, about some of her history. Jamie Robles, along with being a writer and book artist, was one of the founding publishers of the award-winning Five Trees Press, as well as the literary editor of the Lapis Press in Santa Monica. She worked with the publisher and abstract expressionist painter Sam Francis. She founded and was the principal editor for 5 years of Rooms, a literary zine that was a forum for women writers and artists exploring experimental writing and art. And some of my students the first week saw that magazine. She is currently the publisher and editor of the Five Fingers Review and a chapbook series, Woodland Editions, that publishes poetry and sometimes criticism. Jamie Robles has also been a recipient of the 2001 Catherine Green Fellowship to the Jurassic Residence Artists Program, and her series Soundtracks was runner-up in the Poets and Writers California Voices Poetry Contest. She writes libretti for the composer Peter Joshef, and their works have been performed in the Berkeley Art Center and the American Composer Salon, among other places, I believe.
Recent exhibitions of her book arts include books in rereadings at Gallery Lux in San Francisco and Revealing the Mysteries, the development of the arts book at the Center for the Book, also in San Francisco. She curated the fabulous Unbound and Undercover at the Berkeley Art Center. This show of text-based visual art included her installation of poems embedded in wax tablets that recounted the death of her mother. Extremely beautiful wax sheets embedded with text that had candles underneath them, so as the candles burned, the text melted in evanesced. Jamie's work, published work, includes The Poetry of Unseen Stream, published by M. Press, This Narrow Ring, published by Poets and Poets, the powerful Six Mysterious Sides in England, a prose investigation and examination co-written with Eric Holub, This Now Bright Room from Woodland Editions, and the Ulupian experiments of her Woodland Editions book, Loup de Lupo. In Jamie's writing, I see the understated modulations of tone and rhythm that characterize her social comportment, combined with her vast erudition and finely keyed attention, combining to create a poem of subtle drama and tension. I'm going to read you a brief section from This Now Bright Room called Through the Computer. The computer opens its glowing countenance to me. A friend whose name is check for dove or pigeon emails. Know a good auspex, bird diviner? I saw a pigeon attacking a smaller bird over the 2nd and Howard intersection yesterday. A smaller bird, blackbird, kept dodging, and the pigeon would wheel around and slam into it over and over. Never saw such aggressive pigeon activity before. It seemed portentous. I reply, wondering if now, after 43 years, my friend is suddenly going to start speaking in a loud voice, pushing people on the bus and demanding that the people who owe him money pay him back. Portent of the new year is that Daisy has laid an egg, warm in the hand and dull flesh-colored, smooth as marble, after months of molting and egglessness. It's all connected to the sun's reappearance. Her ear and eye pitched to the quotidian will unsettle you, like Jamie herself, with remarkable findings. Jamie Robles.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I had to recognize myself. And now about Ed Dorn. These poems, I'm a Californian, and these poems were written a couple of years ago when I was at Jurassic. And Jurassic still is a part of California that's very much still natural wilderness. And one thing I noticed when I was there, which you don't really often hear, is sound. The sounds were very distinct. So I wrote a series of poems that were about sound. Centered momentarily in the evolution of paths, footsteps, tick-line trail, scattering, here's constant shifting to there, translated by luminiferous space into syllables painted on each eyelid, sun, moon, sun, sea, air, seer, earth, sky, arc. Day's Polaris rises in a template of world glows. Morning stretches. Begin by pushing through the heel, shifting the body, then pushing through the other heel, rippling. Pelvis, waist, ribs, neck, head. Pelvis, waist, ribs, neck, head. Mouth slightly open, relaxed throat, inhale. mouth open, exhaling. A tongue licking space. Toes pull up the scruff of the earth, a dryness from subterranean fissures the earth. Rib reaches to the sky. Walking uphill, my sweaty meat attracts a chorus of admirers. Unwelcome old messengers. Slap cheek on head. Wide-eyed baby rattlers seethe in a 5-gallon plastic bucket. Swallow. Struggling. Scraps. Cross between a whistle and a kiss. Soft palate, tongue raised. A burst of air pushes to escape through the upper teeth. Downy body elongating into air-streamed, dark now feathers, preened, narrow-shouldered, the silvery white belly, yellow clown lips swiftly recede into beak. Mealworms drop one by one into her gapping maw. Her bright whistle. The purposefulness of clouds hung on lows and highs of air. Throat open, soft palate lifted, tongue between back teeth. We extend our arms, holding up little fingers to measure the size of the moon or sun. The wandering of planets, blown about by wind or placed by angels. Lure. Flapping up, down, flutter, cornered in the eye, a brown bird. Raccoon, 10:10 p.m. Strawberry slime, smears, skids of mud in the metal sink, a footprint impressed on a towel with clean dishes along, another distinct track on an upturned saucer. Tongue flat and flipping from the top teeth to the bottom, sharp loop of breath from the throat. Cat, 4 a.m. Balzac enters, promenades the bedroom. Fibrillating tongue behind the teeth, and waves his hindquarters out the sliding glass door. Night walk. A woven gavel of hands and footsteps disappears into the hillside. mouth open slightly, tongue touching a soft palate, abrupt spilling of air as the back of the tongue beats up to the throat and falls away from the palate, ascending singly into an arena of bleached grass. We rise through a triangular grave, cut in the concrete hard earth, soaked in a full moon scape. Wild dogs, those coyotes, whispering in the wings of the wind. Pale heads and long stalks wrap the hills, new mown corona, silence a deep pile of velvet. Near the path, unmown filaments, fiery wind spoked, in sequent longitudinal waves. Chakra. Twisting strands into a single thread. Hey, marsh grasses bent under water's weight, uncombed over wooden planks. Black hair knotted into a solitary thread, stretched across the wall as if harp strings or latitudes of the globe. Red ants forming themselves into ropes along which other ants climb to the table. Cirrus fiber of the fair sky's noon hour. From the end of bamboo skewers, line segments of worms placed into an open yellow throat, triangular tongue, a single strand leading from heart across undisturbed hills to ocean's planar edge, mumbling prayers. I still have some time, so I'm going to read a little bit from a piece, actually, which is about loss, loss not only of the sense of self, but also loss of place. It's a long poetic diary, it's about 25 pages long, but I'm going to read some sections of it, about a woman who's lost her children in a kind of freak accident when they're very young, and their loss, which she never recovers from, is also connected to her loss of a sense of place, or her loss of having left Africa. And along with that is a memory that kind of plagues her, which is the memory or the image of Mary Leakey discovering the bones of the Australopithecus in the Olduvai Gorge, which to her is a kind of representation of how does one find something lost in the vast vastness of the world? This is actually like a Japanese poetic diary done in circles of the year, so it goes through several years. December 2nd. It took some time to live fully, and while waking, I was drawn back into the dream by the image of a naked foot. I had been dreaming about a foot. Some interior voice had spoken of transformation, it stated. The words seemed a key to the lost dream, a means by which I could pull the imagery of the dream forward to my consciousness. To me, a foot meant connection to the earth, and from there, anything. It was only one foot that I dreamed of. In his diary, Nijinsky tells of being lost in a snowstorm outside San Moritz. Wandering, he nearly falls up a precipice, but is saved by a tree. I felt frightened and shouted at the top of my voice, "Death, I do not know why." Deaths accumulate before the first death. It was as if nothing existed except bright breath, wide sky. After that, it was as if a lung, a patch of tissue, the marrow and the bone had darkened and ceased. Since then, death gathers like dust, spreading, fangless, until finally all living tissue left turned black and airless. I am left with only the weight, conscious or not, for more death. May 1st, I dream of my parents. They are young and working in my front yard in what is now, in reality, a patch of rocky dirt and spent daffodils. In the dream, this patch is a deep pool, much like a tide pool, deeper, perhaps endlessly deep. The pool is lined with huge, red, irregularly shaped boulders. My father is moving these boulders, trying to position them correctly in the pool, as if they were the bones of a dislocated spine. The water is dazzling, clear, and cool. My parents are very attentive to the task at hand. August 8th. The heat of the garden, rocks everywhere, covering the dusty clay, red pumice, insistent torpor, unlike sand, the shifting mirage of long landforms at noon. Eventually, heat creeps into the house, making the quiet interiors of rooms more still, like surfaces of water. The pond in the garden, swimming pools, summery lakes, or slow-moving streams. Heat draws one in, like the surface of a pool. August 10th. Sorting through shelves, I found a photograph on a page in a college textbook, the cliffs of Olderby Gorge, undulating in and out of shadows in blurry black and white halftone, broken rocks and bones. A moment reappeared in my imagination, the moment of discovery when, while walking among the rocks in the dry heat of Olderby, Mary Vicky saw the fragment of bone she had been seeking for decades. Then reached down to touch bone rather than rock. Yellow-white bone among yellow-white rocks. How in that vast texture of heat did she find that fragment? Another Africa seeps into that gray photo. My Africa, an Africa of 20-year-old memories. The mauve colors of drying leaves, interminable heat, brown savanna, the gait of giraffes running, the expressions of young Maasai men, their decorous movements, a greeting spit into the dust, the afternoon covers of the Drakensberg, a four-foot snake springing away into the grasses beside the highway, women dancing in a slow circle among bright green-leaved tea bushes, crumbling European cities, a child squatting on the bathroom floor of a steamer, shivering. Jacarandas, mosquitoes, gauze nets, nights restless from heat, Africans washing their clothes near the sea, the water warm, turgid, knees sloshing cautiously through the water, wondering if the ooze beneath my feet was just ordinary muck or an accumulation of feces. There was no tide, it seemed. The waves were small, lacking the foam, rising and falling like shallow breaths of sleep. Air so moist, both sky and sea gray, as if we had suddenly awakened in entropy, some soup of sensations, lacking definition, definition being dependent on differences, extremes. Then through the thick air, Charlie, the white dragon man, calling out, "It's the Indian Ocean." And I, looking up, searching for the horizon at the water's edge, gray and lusterless, beyond which lay another land, saw at last an image materializing, forming itself at the core of which lay longing carried for years, unsuspected, now revealed. Thank you.
Many, many thanks to Tisa and Jamie, and I'll take a 10-minute break and come back for more literary refreshment.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a privilege to introduce Wang Ping, a writer, a scholar, and a teacher. Her gentle, encouraging participation in this year's summer writing program has given rise to enthusiastic reception by her students. Reading her stories and poems makes me realize that I'm reading a fine writer who is cognizant of the workings of the world and the enormous effort it takes to be a woman in it. A feminist gifted with a sly sense of humor, her observations are poignant and sharp. Her latest, she's the author of two collections of poems, two collections of stories, and one novel. And the latest collection of stories is called The Last Communist Virgin, which is out from Coffee House Press. And a recent multimedia exhibit, Behind the Gate, China in Flux After the Flood of Three Gorges Dam, features images, text, and video from Wang's recent trip to China. And actually, you can go to a website called www.wangping.com. It doesn't tell you that she's a practitioner of karate or an ice skater, but it tells her an awful lot. And it's a real pleasure to introduce this fine writer, Wang Ping.
Really not yet. Messenger of this lecture, Chicago Guild Complex. The phone was disconnected, the address wrong. It was February, city covered with ice, wind cutting my leather pants. I roamed downtown Chicago, knocking on doors, looking for the hot house where my reading was scheduled at 8 p.m. Night fell. Cars cruised the street. One packed with laughing men stopped at the curbside. The driver beckoned me to enter. I faked some karate movements and shouted in Chinese, "I'm a poet, not a hooker, you bastard." After that, I started karate. The real ones. Warning ignored. Barnes & Noble, Manhattan. My first and last reading for the best American poetry. 10 minutes maximum, the editor warned sternly. I went out for half an hour and forgot the poem he had asked me to read from the anthology. Wrong audience, Bronx Museum. To please the crowd, I picked my funniest poem of flesh and spirit, but no one laughed, not even at the rhymes, the most powerful curse. Fuck your mother, fuck your grandmother, fuck your great-grandmother of 18 generations. My audience, a group of school children and teachers, stared at me from behind the podium as if I was insane. Some clapped their hands and prayed. Good lesson to learn. Misplaced. Birchbark, Minneapolis, forgot to bring the poem I wrote for Mother's Day. Deadly night, Barnes & Noble, a diner, drove 30 miles in rain to the suburban chain. No one showed up, not a single soul. Truth, Harmar, Roseville. 7:27 p.m., 3 minutes before the meeting, and the father hadn't showed up as promised. Tried to bribe my sons to go to the bookstore with me. "No way, Jose," they said. "We want to wait for Daddy and watch TV." "Forget about your dad. He's out drinking with some woman," I shouted, and dragged them into my car. The store manager waited at the door, looking distressed. Bad traffic, I apologized. Not my mom's fault, my four-year-old son shouted. My dad is out drinking with some woman. Ego or fear, Museum of Modern Art. My first gift to interpret for Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, and Chinese mystic school poets at the grand opening of the American Chinese Poetry Festival. All I did was screaming repeatedly into the microphone, "My name is Penny. Can anyone hear me?" Okay, I'm going to read a group of poems about migration. I've been doing research for several years, traveling back to China, interviewing people. There was 250 million Chinese people, all peasants, bankrupt. They left their villages to go to cities to work, to make products for the big boxes. And now all the those factories that used to be in the city, coastal cities, now they're moving into the inland of China. And so these two poems, this one is called The Dust Angels. It's about those people who make jewelries, cheap jewelries. They make jewelries and in big boxes and ship them through Seattle, through Mexico, and sell, you know, very cheap. And they have no protections, and very soon they get silicosis. It's a poem for them. I read in Chinese, Feng Cheng, Tian Shi. Shui Jing Xing, Fang Zhuan Li, Xin Wei Shi, Mo Mo, Qie Qie, Qie Qie Mo Mo, Feng Cheng Li Man Li, Chu Zhao Zhi Tou, Wei Ta Ren, Chuan Zhi Mei Li, Shou Zhu, Xiang Lian, Jie Zhi, Ye Ye Zhou Zhou, Zhou Zhou Ye Ye, Jian Xiao Fei Lun Qian, Wo Men Gong Yao, Wei Mei Li Jian, Da Mo Shou Shi, Shen Tu, Shang Di, Hu Sa, Yan Chuan Zhong Dai, Fei Gun Er Xia, Si Jian Yi Mei Feng, 穷人的双手, 文明的标奖, 孔雀石, 水晶星, 蛋白石, 地壳深处的宝藏, 在沃尔超市里廉价出售, 枪客连连, 气息难记, 我们的肺腔充满精粉, 我们的生命轻若浮尘, 他们指控我们装病, 与工厂没有任何关系, 他们解除工会, 鼓励时将我们的姓名抹去, 他们说马克思毛泽东早已过时, 只有自由经济的市场, 才是通向民主的大道, 囊中空空, 归家无路, 无言再见父老妻小, 徘徊在医院和法庭的走廊, 苍天啊, 别让我们的孤魂流落异乡, 粉尘天使, 粉尘天使, 是谁从我们的喘息中谋取暴力, 是谁, 带着童工泪珠串起的项链, 谁会知道那成千上万的菩萨, 以我们的骨肉雕成, 那圣母和耶稣的眼睛, 用我们的血汗描绘。 Dust angels, stars, diamonds, tears of hearts, sand and cut and sand, shrouded in silicon fog, we string beauty with corned husking hands. Bracelets, necklace, rings, day and night and day. We bend over screeching wheels, making trinkets for USA. Saints, gods, Buddha, rush down the belt at a dizzying speed. A quarter cent a piece, price of our hands, nation's pride, a civilization eating us alive. Opal, malachite, topaz, stones from deep, sold cheap at Walmart, our lungs harden from quartz crystals, our lives weigh less than dust. We cough and wheeze, we gasp for air, walking half a block. They say we fake sickness, have never worked in their factories. They hire lawyers, they erase our names, ban our union. Marx and Mao are history, they claim. Only freedom of market economy, the golden path towards democracy. no money to go home, no face to see parents, wives, children. All bridges collapsed. We loiter in hospitals, courts. We pray not to die in this strange land. Dust angels, who wear the stars and hearts strung with our tears? Who made a fortune from our wretched breath? Who will see us of all the Buddha and saints carved out of our bodies, of all the eyes of Mary and Jesus painted in our blood? Chinese government just passed a law requiring foreign companies in China to give written contracts to Chinese workers and pay them minimum wage. And so those corporates are threatening to move those factories out of China and move them to Vietnam and Mexico. And this one is about love song from a prostitute. And I grew up in China during Mao's period, and Mao did a lot of terrible things and killed millions of Chinese people. But he did three things pretty well, I think. One is he just cleaned up the drug addiction, and two is cleaned up all the brothels, and three, of course, well known is kick out all foreigners. And now, all these things, three things all went back, run rampant. And when I left China in 1985, Chinese doctors did not know how to diagnose sexual disease. And now there are 20 million women working as sex workers. Wild pheasant is a euphemism for Chinese for prostitute, and the blue house is a euphemism for brothels. Her boy is Chinese term for lover, for male lover. Venus points to the mid-sky moon. My path is drenched with silvery dew. A wild pheasant calls from a blue house terrace. Red are my lips, dark is love. Painted phoenix cannot fly. Pain in my heart has no tongue. I was daughter of yellow earth. You were son of mountains and ravines. Two small children with bowl-cut hairdos. We played without shame or suspicion. At 20, mother opened my face with silk thread. A red sedan carried me to your new cave. Three nights after, you set off for the coast. I grabbed your sleeve, hugged your neck. Why did you bother to marry if you had to leave so soon? You dragged your feet two steps forward, three steps back. Bride and groom, 3 days new. How our tears broke like partridge eggs. Venus sinks to the west, leaning on the moon. My path makes no sound under wet moss. A wild pheasant calls from a blue house window. Come, my angels, rest your souls at my perfumed feet. Pairs of toads leap in the spring. Our love song echoes ravine to ravine. At the end of the road, I took out my needle and sewed my heart into your shirt. Go, my love, don't look back. If you're hungry, there's bread in the sack. Heat your meals and cover your belly. Don't forget your bride. Don't pick flowers on the road. I will plow the fields, care for our parents. My door will be locked until you return with a cart full of grain. Venus shines, lighthouse for stars. Along my path, shadows scurry in dim alleys. A wild pheasant calls from blue house eaves. Short is my skirt, tender as my scented sleeves. Terrace is plowed by buffaloes. This world is seeded with sorrow. My love, You are mud ox sunk in the sea. Nothing returns since you left me. I call heaven and earth, but who will hear, who will see? Only tears drip from a crushed heart. A long shadow hovers over the deep well. Venus weeps on the brew house roof. At dawn, my path crowds with sleepless souls. A pheasant calls under the old white star. Long is my hair, tangled love in the teeth of fate. 10,000 geese fly to the north. 10,000 letters wait for a home. Once mating, wandering ducks never part. My hurt boy, 6 years is too long without you. Some rule with slogans, some rain with commercials. But who will give back my husband? Let us raise the young, grow old in peace. Roaming from city to city, I ask your name to woman, paint your face to signs of man. Whatever happened, I must find you. Alive, I will drag you to mother's knees, our five-year-old son you have never seen. Dead, I will take your bones, rest them next to your father, wine and incense to light your path. The moon has completed her journey. From darkness to darkness, I linger. A wild pheasant calls with a splintered throat. Gold star of Venus, please shine your light on my path. I'm a pheasant, a spittoon filled with cigarette butts. My flesh rots beneath powder and rouge. But the fire has never died in my temple. Love is there if you see it, dewdrops of face bejeweling its upturned eaves. Do not move. Let birds stir in their nests. Let pheasants, fairies from this tattered earth, carry the sun in our beaks. If you go to New York, or if you probably, you will see a lot of Chinese restaurants and along East Broadway. Those restaurants are actually opened by Fujian people who jumped the ships or flew by planes with fake passports. And some of them actually they called asylum jumpers. It's a pretty new phenomenon, actually, after the 1993 Rockaway Golden Ventures incident, and those people, about almost 300 people jumped the ship at Rockaway Beach in New York, and 10 drowned, and the rest were arrested and put in jail for 4 years until... And most of them actually were deported back to China, and some of them were killed immediately because they owed huge debt. At that time, it's $30,000. They paid to snakeheads to come to the United States, and now actually the price is $60,000 to come over. And some of them immediately borrowed another same amount and tried to come over, and they actually tried several times and failed. And so after that, Chinese, all those people actually, Fujian people, they come out of the same village called Changle. The literal translation is eternal happiness. And that village had over 3,000 tradition of crossing the ocean. And so I've been working with this 16-year-old boy. Now he's actually 18. When he left home, he had to flee because his parents joined the underground Catholic Church in China, in that village, and were arrested. And he had to flee because the police was going after him. And so he went on the same route. It's called the snake route. Went around half of the world and went on a hunger strike in Vienna. And finally, he did the asylum jump, which is he just stripped all his paper, stripped all his identity in the airplane, and when his plane landed in JFK, he just forced himself through the yellow line, which is the line of passport line, to be on American soil, and then he would have rights. He would be physically present on the American soil to claim asylum. And I have been helping this boy to gain some rights. And after I heard this story, I wrote this poem. And it's not just individual poem, it's the poem, it's the life of millions of people who took the boats across the sea and or jumped the line. Called, "This is how you cross the line. Any alien who is physically present in the United States may apply for asylum. INS item 208. First, you gather the paper, plane tickets, photos, letters, passports, all fake, but for yuan, euros, pounds, fake certificate, fake license, fake face, everything about you, even the names, round them up with care, tear them, shred them, chew them, flush them, the pulp down the toilet before the plane touches the ground. You come out clean as blank paper, belong to no country, no race, no man or woman. You are on your own, bleached in the mirror, listless, no hair grown on your phantom face. That is not yours, the fear, the hunger, the thirst, the urge to throw yourself on the ground and cry, Mama. No. You walk along the thin corridor, along with the fellow passengers in suits and perfume, who snore and grind their teeth in their dreams, who rush towards custom, the baggage claims, to the shadows hovering behind opaque glass, bouquets, homecoming banners, limousines. And you stand in line. You choose a booth with a woman officer, pudgy, pasty white, a contrast to the young, stout body that is not yours. You look around. The girl from Fuzhou, still a skeleton, from the two-week hunger strike in Amsterdam, had picked an obese man. Her tender ankles curve like talons. Over there, under the neon, flickering, citizens only, you see the man behind the line, poised to jump, dyed beard, dyed hair, the scar on his temple pulsing red, a lighthouse leading you across the Indian, the Atlantic, the Nordic Sea. His lined fists catch you safe from snakes in the holds of rusty ship. You want to throw yourself at his feet. Uncle Wu, where have you been? But you freeze, your face a mask like his, hers, and others, whose names you must erase from your 16-year-old heart. Suddenly, I'm alone. Before me, no human shield, no bridge behind to flee, to jump or die. Stop, breathe, slow, deep, pack pockets one more time. Everything set. No baggage, no name, no memory, only this body, no longer mine, never mine, having crossed endless borders and seas, for this final sprint. The officer looks up, eyes shadowed with overnight fatigue. A smile across her face and your knees buckle in that small second. Mother, will she be on the other side? The land of panting. But up is her finger, next, and you push a puppet pulled by the invisible string. The smile recedes from her eyes, ripples of shock, fear, alarm. Push, carrying nothing, everything, past the booth, the yellow line of authority, past the guard huffing over, gun in hand, pushing, a fetus, declaring asylum. Here's a woman who is in America. Looking after a Chinese adoptee in Brooklyn. It's called On the Playground in Brooklyn. A retired neurologist from Beijing is cursing a Henan girl. Sit still, you little pumpkin shit-faced. Stop fidgeting and stop whining about your sore feet. If your mother hadn't left you outside a shoe factory dumping you like bad luck, you'll be digging mud and collecting cow dung in some godforsaken place. You'll be lucky to have some cornmeal to fill your stomach, some rags to cover your ass, and God bless if your father agreed to send you to school for 2 years, just enough to get a job sewing buttons, embroidering napkins and tablecloths at some Chinese-American joints. You'll be lucky to marry a peasant from another village, to have a kid within the quota. If a boy, you'll be pampered. If a girl, you'll be cursed and beaten. Or if you were pretty, which you are not, you will sell your flesh at hotels, bus stations. If you were intelligent, which I doubt, you might get into college, suck up to your professors for a better grade. But this is how fate laughs in your faces. You, a little nothingness, live in a brown house, brownstone in this filthy rich neighborhood. And I, a venerable doctor and professor, wait on you 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, for minimum wage. You kick at your food like a spoiled princess. Your Gap outfit and elephant shoes cost more than my daily salary. All because you call some white-skinned lawyers Papa and Mama, who hardly see you except on Sundays, who want you to speak English without an accent, and hopefully pick up a few Chinese words from your nanny. No way. Listen carefully, you little hoof. A whore is always a whore, just like a dog will never grow ivory from its jaw. Born in a peasant's style, you will always smell of mud and straw fermented in piss, your eyes the cutting wind from the yellow plateau, your feet thick, thighs bulging with muscles, hips wide for labor sex birth, even though at 3 and a half you still look like a 2-year-old, still wobble when you stand or walk, the bare back of your head flat like the bottom of a pan. Believe me, I'm a doctor, I know. Once a peasant, forever a peasant. Just as a Chinese remains a Chinese, wherever she goes, even in her grave. Why are you crying, you little oily mouth? You're not supposed to understand a word. 2 years in America should have wiped out your past, erased all memory. But who am I kidding? A night alone on the cement steps of a factory, a year spent in an orphanage. They say the trauma has stunted your growth hormone. But who hasn't gone through a few things in this life? I've survived 2 prisons, 3 labor camps, the Cultural Revolution, and now this plot at age 60 to become a maid for an outcast to support my good-for-nothing son and his family. And I'm still standing tall, defiant. So, Lily, my silly pumpkin face, wipe your nose and walk. Time to practice again. You're stubborn and proud. Good. Don't ever let your parents' frown seal your lips. Don't let their butter and steak wash your brain. You are Chinese, a Chinese peasant girl. Now take your steps. It's all right to stumble, to fall. Here's my hand. Take it. I'm your countrywoman. I'm your mother. Thank you.
Under Flag, winner of the 1991 Multicultural Publishers Book Award, Commons 2002, possibly my favourite book of poetry in the whole world, and most recently River Antis. When the writer Yedda Morrison asked Myung-Mi Kim if writing poetry could retrain a person to occupy a life or a society differently, she replied, "Yes, absolutely. If I can begin to occupy that space of tending and attending, of attention and of tracking subtleties, and to project out of that space with a kind of perseverance that's not just like determination, but a perseverance that's in the service of tracking complexity, then I'm getting somewhere. I mean, if I manage this vis-à-vis my work, if this becomes a poetics, it has to alter the way I take in the world and the others around me. These uncertain and undecidable spaces of, am I making a difference? Will this contribute? How can I know? Those undecidable locations are actually part of the work. It doesn't feel great. It's not that kind of exhilarated state, or at least not for very extended periods of time, but it is a lived state, and it's a true one. Mia Mikin.
From a new project tonight, but in order to do that, I thought I'd read a little bit from Commons initially, and maybe say, in fact, a little bit before that, that starting with the book called Dura, I feel like in some sense I'm writing into one book, and so Dura would be the first, Commons would be the second, and what I'm going to read tonight, called Penury, would be the third book of whatever this sort of unfolding book is. So in that, given that, please understand and come to some kind of greeting point with the poem, understanding there's a lot of material I'm not reading, but I do hope that I've been able to call and shape and I hope evoke the kind of larger concerns and musics and questions and that are embedded in what you'll be hearing. So this is from Commons, the section called Lamenta. Give ear to the quarrels of the marketplace. When the wheel A was turned, the gate B was raised, thus allowing water to flow from C to D, giving clearance for the ship to pass beneath. Lever, girt, host, and parasite, implicated armed band, where would one live? Witness and continual waking, raging, stretching, and casting, now chanting, now weeping. The medicine is that the head be shaved, washed in lukewarm vinegar, the forehead anointed with the juice of lettuce or of poppy. If the witness lasts 3 days without sleep, there is no hope of recovery. War-torn, turbulent homeland. All that we see could also be otherwise. All that we can describe could also be otherwise. The thing seen is the thing seen together with the whole space. Why are many buildings necessary with so small a farm area? The heat of the midday sun is obvious, but the pressure of populations on the inadequate areas of flat land has to be inferred. For the flock, a brief flash announces possible food. Shun, nestle, ravenous, sealed, ash, dust. To settle refugees, to remove landmines, and their task leaked. The question is labor. Skin loosening from bone is age. Ages longer than drought or rain, grafted. The fundamental tenet of all military geography is that every feature of the visible world possesses actual or potential military significance. Little flower, what day is it? The light stops at 1 o'clock. A rain-saturated tree trunk becomes a feeling. The city of one's birth and the people inside it. Helicopters hover, embassy compound. Fish with two tails, fish with two heads, indigestible over days and days. War is there and travel. The same is my sister, brothers, and mother. The father is fresh white at birth and at dusk. Father is burying ground cool to the touch. Left their homes after 2 solid days of attacks. They had stayed to take care of their cow. The extreme cold froze medicine. Religion and capitalism intersect in the muddy village 20 miles north of. Enemies surround us, but even our own people have turned into lepers, lions, and wolves, snatching anything that moves, boils, eat us up. Grief would have so a mark, wilt and mold, diminishing possibility of cucumber and pole bean vine, human face worn by animals, a vowel worried by use, break fall of nations, the gnawed pleasure boats. Much of the material that shapes penury proceeds in relation to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, read in the broader context of massive global displacements of workers and citizens, ecological devastation, the violence of militarism on human bodies, and the politics of linguistic oppression. For me, the best way I could say this in a short way tonight is that penury is a mourning book or a book of mourning. I'm wondering about what mourning activates. What is the meaning of the labor of mourning on behalf of culture? Reader of the announcement of the spirit. Place in the nose a piece of blue paper. The hair is combed and parted in the middle. Any fallen hair is collected and put in a pouch. With a spoon carved from a willow tree, place 3 spoonfuls of rice in the mouth, 7 times bound with rope. Suplar is not a word. Mustard yellow is. Said the master, the student, said the bumbling ones. Storm, stam. The makeshift shelters direct proportion of drinking water to raw sewage. Aspirin, barb. Just a normal customer, no heavy accent at all. The entire vertical profile from atmosphere to subsurface, columns and processions of being in and affecting, I don't know what's the problems in that family, probably poorness. Those 840 workers, they're just gone. Lookout post. Are these your names? From, where from, where are you from? Say this, me speaking. To burn or to expose to the threat of the sun, a person with a pigeon chest and protruding stomach. The said, release, annexed, surrendered. Majority of members, in consideration of lawful money, the said water frontage and the above described lands, rolling country, small poplar bluffs, one arrow transcript. Ari Aubrey Sway, someone teaches topic sentence. They must be taught the language which they must use in transacting business with the people of this country. Do you eat berries, mushrooms, fish, and game? Most likely how it entered your body. Foundry, mill, warehouse, tannery, refinery, central clearing hall, infirmary, barracks, internment camp, auto plant, containment center, refugee camp. Perimeter, offset, claim, crucial, quarter, branch, full, tip, time, and place, scan, yes sir, I do, do. Three of those were fixing it, no seeing them, elements buffer in that twitch feel of limbs, there's no fixing it, huddled, quadrant, counting, inhabitants, operative spot, who's in there, who's there, blaring, route will be returned as practicable as possible. 303 transcript. In attendance on a person. Don't lie. Don't say retrievable. Shift each tag and marked. Obverse view J. Nitrogen oxides, heavy metal, mercury deposits. Not people, dogs, lowly animals, we were taught. The dead framed in black cardboard. Obverse view K. Sacrifices to those who have died in epidemics. The demand for young, slender women. She thought she heard the photos. Minimum human subsistence experiment. Deemed not worthy of destroying. Public order, kneeling on the ground, hastily dug ditches, syringes, hoarding, withholding design to start the whole region into submission. The place I'm from is no longer on any map. Expert shores, toppling, hunt, continue, hunt, bulldog, help, hunt, claim vital time and place prohibited, shield, slip, burst, wave, accelerate, swarming, handheld, toll, scrutinize, green color on the face, control, wear down, tam, take away, choice, heavy knotted, free, flash, skyward. 704, transcript. Brigade, gang, stinging nettles, wild side swing, machines hunch, vehicles in and out, one arrow transcript. You are now leaving the American sector. Perpetual savings and loan, avenue of technology, drudgery of use, shamble, fall, under an obligation or necessity. When the fish die all at once and appear on the banks all at once. Could the rock be that yellow, canary yellow, corresponding pelvis bowl, bunker buster bomb? Ruins, library, where perceived hindering say birds congregating on a runway, where the instruction harness these to the benefit of your society, where the conscription continued, where boards of revenue, where basically everyone had a plant job, where preventable diseases rampant, where the need is window screens and sewer covers, where for the good of the very few and the suffering of a great many. Fighting house by house. You saw it and you heard it. Grass grew from the sternum. Roots took over the mandible. Place fruit of red colors to the east. Place fruit of white colors to the west. Go to the root and call out the name. Hooded, fortune, snare, willful, wheeled, hummock, pled, sweet water, bottled, abrupt, bundle, specular, scruple, prone, river spray, with head bowed, walked, trudged, iron leaf once, trumpets, hump spine blackened with flies. When the book is opened and the dead march, barrow, flower, bulldoze, sun.